accession number 27185, reel 62.
Major Barras, reel 62.
Well, some more sort of go-backs, if I can, to
carry on.
You're on?
Yes.
Okay. When I was at depot, I said I was called training major, which I thought was a bit strange, actually. Mm-hmm. When I wrote to the president of the Essex Regiment Association about this awful Lads Army television thing, he sent a copy off to the keeper of the museum, who he thought might have had something to do with it. And he referred to me as OC Training Company, which sounds better.
Much more likely.
So yes, because I did have powers of... I know I held company office. I used to have the people up and on charges and things like that. So I must have had the powers of company commander.
Yeah.
So I was OC Training Company there. And, of course, the depot commander would have been a CO in that case. He would have been commanding officer. The other thing is that I said there was... a chap there I got very friendly, a family we got very friendly with from the King's Own Royal Regiment, and his name was Nigel. I remembered his surname now, it was Gribben, Major Gribben. Nigel Gribben, who was going to be of some considerable use to me later in the War Office. He stayed on in the Army and I think finished up as a general.
Yeah.
I think he did very well. There was a couple of things. One is that we were told not to eat salads there whatsoever because it was the way that they were manured. It was what was called night soil, politely. So a lot of diseases had in the past been contracted through eating it, and we were warned right off it. In fact, we're forbidden to eat it at all. I don't know whether I mentioned the use of mules during...
You're saying that mules were required for resupply in the...
Yes, mountains. Which caused me a lot of thinking and learning.
Why was that?
Well, because I'd never used mules before. I mean, they were used in Burma and Italy, and they became, no doubt, the staff officers and adjutants and people who had to deal with them became very professional. But I, at that stage, I didn't know how long it took to get them up, what their loads were, how many we could have, and what we could put on. I learnt that there was a pack transport company there, that's what they called them, of 350 mules. I've got this, I have found this written down at home, I don't know why, but each transport company consisted of four troops, and each of those eight sections, and each section had eight or nine mules, which included sick or reserve. Each mule could carry 160 to 180 pounds, but they could only do a round trip of 16 miles. So it meant that roadhead, in other words, where the stuff was offloaded from trucks onto the mules, couldn't be further than 8 miles away from where you wanted it brought up, which, well, obviously wasn't right in the front line, but near enough so it could be distributed around the battalion. So, as I say, I had a fair amount of information to get and work out there, and I think we got used to it after a bit. We lost a couple of mules down the side of the Cudder. I mean, they were...
They slithered over.
Yeah, yeah.
Who drove them for you?
They were muleteers, or whatever they called them. They had their own people. They were, I think, I don't know, either Gurkhas or... They certainly weren't Chinese Hong Kong, because obviously the company had come in from outside. So they were probably Gurkhas, Indians. They weren't British. They had British officers. But the muleteers were... I think Indian.
Presumably they would have been Royal Coral Transport.
Oh, yes. They were with them all the time. Mm-hmm. And they knew the mules and which mules were good ones and which were going to cause trouble. And they were thoroughly professional. The other thing is, about this time, I got a notification asking if I would sit on the 2nd Battalion, the Essex Regiment Battle Honours Committee. which was going to be held the next month, I think. Well, as I was in Hong Kong, I couldn't get there, so I never attended.
Were you able to correspond with them at all, to put in any ideas?
I know, because I wrote back and said, sorry, I couldn't do won't be there, so they obviously got somebody else, I suppose. Mm. I never heard any more. Well, November came, and the annual British Forces tattoo, which I think I mentioned last November, which were very popular amongst the local population. I found this everywhere we've been, and they're good for relations with the locals to hold these tattoos, which we can do very well, I think, probably better than most.
Were you involved in organising it at all?
No, I wasn't. We provided the band and drums for and a guard of honour to meet the whoever was going to take the salute at the tattoo. And we provided the band and drums for the mass bands. But I think that's all we did.
Did you have anything to do with the local Hong Kong forces?
No.
As a result of that?
No. I personally didn't. I don't remember ever having anything to do with them. We did with the police, and I think I went into some detail, I think, about what we had to learn in the way of support of the civil power.
Yes, riot drills.
Riot drill and so forth, and in those conditions we met the local police, I can remember that. But we were never called out. Mm. So, really, that brings us to the end of 1955, during which year, of course, Churchill resigned as Prime Minister, and Eden, who'd been champing at the bit at the side, eventually became PM. Some might say later with disastrous results. There was the Anglo-Egyptian Treaty, which signed that year, I think, which required British troops to be withdrawn from the Canal Zone after 70 years there. That was going to cause us a lot of problems later, too. So 1956 dawned. I don't think there was little out of the ordinary in the beginning of the year. We just carried on. Most of the things I've described already, I think. I know we did have some battalion and brigade exercises during the cool weather. And then, of course, the coolness began to turn slowly to the summer heat and humidity. And I think we carried on a bit then. And then we changed from battle dress into jungle green again. And we must have got information, I suppose, I don't know, in the spring, if you like to call it that there, April, that we were due to go home to the UK. And at what time we got the information we were to merge with the Bedfords and Hertfords, I don't know, but we must have known before we went home, because we knew on the ship.
What was the feeling about that within the battalion?
Well, if it had been the original battalion, which I joined, I think there would have been a total dismay. But you've got to remember, this battalion it had got hotchpotch a bit. I didn't know a lot of the officers there. There were a lot of short service officers. There were one or two from the TA who had taken regular commissions and hadn't had nobody there had had long-term connection with the battalion or felt in any way sort of dedicated to that particular battalion. I mean, a lot of the soldiers were National Service and they were only for the 2 years. Some of the warrant officers and sergeants were still some of the old ones from before the war, but they were due for demob anyway, or retirement, as you put it. So I don't think there was much concern, quite honestly. I don't remember any. Paul Clemente Smith, the commander, our CO, who was an extremely nice man, very easy to work with, and very knowledgeable, but as I explained earlier, fairly laid back. And I don't think he had much intention of staying on in the army after. Well, I don't think he did, actually. I don't know whether he got another appointment, but he didn't move on after being a lieutenant colonel. I heard the other day, by the way, that he's still alive. He retired in Norfolk and started a chicken farm, so I was told. He's now 90. I think it was Mike Holm told me he's 92 or 93 now and still going strong. So perhaps early retirement isn't a bad thing after all. So at some stage we obviously learnt that we were going to merge with the Bedfords and become the 3rd Battalion of what then was going to be called the East Anglian Regiment. Or was it Brigade? I think it was the East Anglia Regiment. So probably around about April or May, probably even later than that, we would have been told our date on which we're going to embark, because we were dependent entirely on the vagaries of the troopship program. And later we heard that the date was fixed for July, and it was going to be the Empire Windrush, which was one of Hitler's strength through joy ships.
You've been on that one before.
I've been on that one before. There was also another one called the Empire Windrush, which I think I'd been on as well at some stage. They were very fast, actually. I remember when I went out to Hong Kong, the Devonshire, which was one of the original troop ships, which was still going strong, that and Dunera was another one, started 4 days ahead of us, and we overtook it somewhere in the Indian Ocean. So they were pretty fast.
Were they comfortable?
Well, as far as anybody who had a cabin, yes, they were very comfortable. But, of course, when you get down to the troop ships, they're very stuffy and not much privacy. I think they had a hard time sometimes in the troop decks, I mean. Well, I had to start planning embarkation. This is my second experience, because as adjutant of Bedford's, I had to do the return from Greece. But this one seemed to be more complicated, because there were more people, more married families here, and it was longer, and it was going to be much longer than we thought it was originally going to be. So first job was to estimate the number of crates everybody required, and it's okay, you can do it for companies, and a lot of the stuff had their dedicated crates, like the colours and band instruments and heavy weapons and that sort of thing, although we didn't take heavy weapons back with us. All the transport and heavy stuff was left behind. I don't know whether we got relieved there or whether the stuff was just left there and either brought home separately or sold off to local people or what. They wouldn't have sold them the mortars and stuff, but some of the transport might have been sold off. So we then had to get an estimate from all the families as to how many crates they wanted, which had to be made, and this was the most difficult task of all, because when you're loading a ship, it's not the weight, it's the space that counts.
The volume, yes.
However, the Pioneer platoon, assisted by manpower labour from the contractor, got down, having got the numbers required, made them, handed them out. The men were left carrying their rifles. That was all they were left with. Now, they were entitled to a C kit bag, another kit bag, and a big pack. That was their allowance. The baggage was then had to be divided into three lots. There was a company baggage which could be taken into the cabin of those who had cabins, which were officers, warrant officers, and sergeants, I think, and of course all married families. The soldiers on the troop decks were allowed their sea kit bag. And the other kit bag they had to go into what was called either wanted on voyage or hold. Now, the wanted on voyage, again, was restricted. I mean, you were restricted how much you could take as a company baggage. You were restricted how much you had on wanted on voyage. And that was packed away in a hold somewhere. And every day they opened it up, and you could go in there and have rummage around in your bags and crates. Well, you wouldn't have the crates there because they'd be screwed down and put in the hold. But you probably had some bags and things in there if you wanted, suddenly found you wanted something. So everybody had to think what they wanted immediately, what they might want on the voyage, and what they didn't want the voyage, which went down in the hold. So we had to get the whole baggage on the quayside before the ship arrived. So that was all down there and put in what they called a go-down or a warehouse. And then when the ship came in, the CEO, myself, I think the RSM and the quartermaster went down there to meet the OC troops on the ship. He was a lieutenant colonel. And the OC troops on the ship was responsible to the captain, for all the service personnel on board. Because there weren't just army there, there were Royal Naval individuals, there were individuals from the Royal Air Force going home on demob or leave. So we would go down there, meet him, and then try and work out cabin allocation, troop deck allocation.
Was that done by the OC troops? Then?
Yes.
Not by the ship's officers? Or?
No, nothing to do. We only dealt with the OC troops. We never dealt with the ship's officers. I mean, only on a social basis,
yes.
Or casually, you might
not,
talk.
Not business.
Not business, no. The OC troops was responsible to the captain for everything that went on with the service personnel. If anybody had a complaint about us or anybody else, they would take it to OC troops. And then he would deal with it. As we were a battalion with a CO, he would obviously, if it was any one of ours, he'd obviously have CO in and say, look, this has happened, do you mind dealing with it? If it was an individual or a draft travelling on its own, then he would have to deal with it himself.
Direct.
And he had disciplinary powers of some sort. But there's not an awful lot you could do on a ship.
Keelhaul.
Apart from throwing somebody overboard or having a keelhaul. Yes. So, but if the captain or any member of the ship's crew had a problem with us, then they would go to OC troops. They wouldn't deal with us at all. They'd go to OC troops and then he would deal with it.
Would they go up through the captain or would they go direct to OC troops?
Oh, I think they'd have to go through. Well, it may not be the captain. It might be a sort of a senior officer who would be designated to as a sort of liaison man between the ship and the ship's crew and the services. I don't think the captain would really get involved. Captain's chap who was supposed to stand right up on top of everybody else and make long-term decisions.
Yeah.
But no doubt the OC troops and the captain had a good relationship, or should have had a good relationship. So everything had to be labelled. One had one's name, regiment, and Southampton, I remember, still had some crates up to a short while ago with my name, rank, and Southampton painted on the side. So then I had to indent for transport to get us there because we couldn't get there ourselves. And I think I remember when it came to the battalion, I had something over 33 tonners because we all had to go at once.
All in one package?
All in one package, yeah. And a lot of the families who couldn't be picked up by staff cars and things were able to book taxis and reclaim and get there. So everybody had a time to get there. Now the companies had to arrive 10 minutes between each other, and then they had to arrive in alphabetical. They had to be get off their transport and queue up on the gangway in alphabetical order, and a list in alphabetical order had to be handed to a very senior NCO, probably a warrant officer, standing at the bottom of the gangway, who then checked everybody aboard. So that eventually, when everybody was, he ticked everybody's name off, he could say everybody's aboard or somebody's missing or whatever.
Did you have any missing?
I don't remember. Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think anybody wanted to be missed, quite honestly.
Who was responsible for actually organising the companies internally? Was it the OC company in each case?
Yeah, the OC company would be responsible. He would get his company clerk, I suppose, to make out a list of everybody in the company in alphabetical order, so it could be handed to the NCO at the bottom of the gangway. And then A company would arrive, debus, queue up, go aboard, be taken down to their deck. 10 minutes later, the next company would arrive. And then they may well have, I mean, the deck, the quayside was a vast area, so I mean, some of them might have arrived and been sort of standing, the vehicles holding back further down the quay and waiting to come forward.
Who actually did the marshalling of the troops once they got on board? Was that done by NCOs of the battalion or the detachment?
Well, the RSM would be responsible for calling people forward and doing this, that, and the other. We would, you see, when I went down with the CO, afterwards, we would have taken guides down to the ship. Whether I would have done it or the RSM would have done it, I don't know. Probably the RSM would have done it. Then you have to have guides to all the cabins. I mean, you've got a mass of cabins there with the whole families arriving, with kids, brown paper parcels. It's quite a horrendous business.
But, I mean, were you doing all that internally, and the ship's crew didn't have anything to do with guiding you to cabins or settling you?
No, I don't think the ship's crew has had anything to do with it at all.
It was all done by yourselves.
We did it ourselves, because we had done our reconnaissance.
Yeah.
No, they wouldn't have had anything to do with it. In fact, we had very little to do with them. The only time we ever met them really were on social. Social conditions, parties, captains, cocktail party and something like that.
Yes.
Or meal times for officers anyway, because we travel first class and the officers from the ship would be there at the tables. Each table would have an officer from the ship as sort of father. Well, like a cruise ship, actually. Mm. So we were all packed in and sailed. Now, one of the problems we had, of course, was it was middle of summer, very hot. And as I mentioned before, being in the troop decks wasn't a lot of fun. They were close together, it was stuffy. And what we did was to get them up on deck whenever we possibly could. For PT games, competitions, and we had to do because we had to keep them going in their trade, so we also did weapon training and anything else we could think of, really. In the evenings, of course, there was the game of see going on down there. I was told there was an officer who couldn't bring himself to say housey, and he called it the game of house. I thought it was beneath him to say housey. So the most important thing there was the health morale of the troops.
Welfare.
And the welfare, yeah. It was easier once we got into the Mediterranean out in the cooler weather. But afternoon was usually spent in Egyptian PT, which was lying on their hammocks. Well, we used to have general knowledge games, you know, all kinds of things. Yes, anything we could think up to keep them occupied. I think young Tim had his first birthday there too. They had a big nursery on board, a very good team of nurses who looked after the children. So you could dump them in there, and they'd look after them. And I think they gave him a... I mean, he wouldn't have known. I don't think he really realised now. But he had a cake with one candle on it, and everybody else enjoyed the cake. I don't know whether he did. But they were very good and very useful, because when the only opportunities we got are going ashore anywhere... They were there to look after the children. Anyway, we sailed, and the first port of call was Singapore, which I don't think much happened. We may have, of course, by this time, I'm not sure whether Singapore had its independence by then.
Apparently that came later.
I think it did, in which case we might well have taken some troops aboard. Then we went on to Colombo and Ceylon. Well, they've been independent for 8 years, so we must have been there for just oiling, nothing else, I suppose. But we did go ashore. I remember we took our children too with us. We went down to Mount Lavinia along the coast, which we'd been to before, and had a swim there. I remember leaving young Tim in his cot underneath the palm trees in the shade, and took Christopher, three of us went in the sea. And then we went to Bombay, which of course was in India, was independent then by then. We stayed there 2 days. And it was very hot and sticky there. I remember we went ashore again and we went swimming. Everybody went swimming on the beaches. I can't remember the beach of Bombay. I can see it, but I can't remember what it was called. Paradise, I think it was called, or South Paradise Beach or something like that. And then when we got on board, we were looking over the side of the ship, quite high up, down on the quayside. And an Indian arrived with a wicker basket and a small rug. Smoothed out the rug, or mat, as it was, opened the wicker basket, and got out a mongoose and a snake. And by this time, of course, large crowds had appeared on the decks to watch all this. And he put them opposite one another. And it was a very hot day, and nothing happened. They obviously didn't want to fight.
Not interested.
No, not sliced, but interested. And then he sort of got hold of the mongoose and sort of shoved it at the snake. And I don't think the mongoose had any teeth anyway. He sort of did a sort of couple of gnaws at the back of the snake and then retired, and the snake said, cut it out, it's too hot. And by this time there was loud sort of jeers and shouts from everybody on deck. And he packed him up and stalked off, and I think he may gave his mongoose and snake good dressing down when he got home.
Were they sharing the basket then when you packed them all?
Yes.
Back? They were.
Yes,
so
they all came out of the same basket. That was the only thing. They weren't naturally fighters. I think they'd sort of reckoned that they had to perform. And
they were retired.
I think they were retired, yes. They certainly didn't earn any much money. It was hilarious. Anyway, we sailed after having refueled there. And our next port of call was Aden. Now, when we were there... in fact, we had learnt before we got there, we must have done over the ship's communication, but we also got the BBC overseas broadcast.
World Service
broadcast over the ship, when the news, that NASA, Colonel NASA, had nationalised the Suez Canal.
Had you had any premonition?
Nothing at all, no. Nothing at all. I think, we may have done, but I don't think anybody had it. He just suddenly did it. And that was on the 26th of July he did it. And we arrived there a couple of days after he'd done it in Aden.
Yes.
So there was some doubt as to what we should do. And we got word from London that we were to stay there whilst the cabinet met. And remember, Eden was now Prime Minister. Mm. To decide what we should do. And eventually, after 2 days, we got the message through that we were to go around the Cape of Good Hope and not go through the canal. Well, we were vulnerable. If we'd gone into the canal, he could have blocked both ends.
Could have been hostages.
And we could have been hostages, yeah. And I don't think there was much point in thinking too long about it, but they've considered it in London. That was their decision, which was obviously the right one. So... we were to add on another 2 weeks or more to our trip, which in fact took about, I think it was at least six weeks we were on board. May have been longer, seven, because we stayed in port. In one respect, we were lucky because we had a regimental band on board, and they were very good at going around giving concerts everywhere, dances. And they had a string, also a string section, which might have been okay at tea time in the first class lounge, but I doubt whether it had much appeal down in the troop decks on that.